Good morning. It is good to be here with you amongst the living. I've been down and sick this past week. In fact, everyone in my home has been. You know, there's a lot of things they try to prepare you for. When you have kids, they tell you things like, you know, they'll test your patience better than anyone else ever will. Very true. They'll tell you you'll never have the financial security that you hope to have to be ready to have kids. Another true statement. One thing I wish people would have told me more of, though, children are nasty. They bring home everything that they possibly can, okay? So, you know, I don't think I've ever been as sick as I ever have been in my life as when I started to have kids. I'm about to implement the mask rule in my home. At 24/7, you've got to wear that mask unless you're locked in your room asleep. But it's funny, they always give it to you worse than they had it. You know, your kid comes in, little cough, little 99 fever, one day, they're better. Great. Okay. If I catch this, nothing. 6 days later. Okay. That's how it seems to work with them. But I'm grateful that I feel well enough. And per doctor's orders, I am allowed to be here today as well. Jonathan Swift, the author of Gulliver's Travel, if you're like me, you know the name of the book. You remember that you were supposed to read it in high school, but you probably didn't. Look up the Cliff Notes. That's kind of what I did in those situations. I'm one of those people. If a book, a movie, a television show, it's got 3 to 5 minutes to catch my attention. If it doesn't catch it in 3 to 5 minutes, I can't power through it. I'm sorry. If you could see my Netflix list, continue watching. There's probably like 10 back-to-back that are lined up, and the little red line's only about that full on it. Didn't catch my attention quick enough. Move on to something else. But the author of Gulliver's Travel, Jonathan Swift, once said, "We have just enough religion to make us hate, but not enough to make us love one another." We have just enough religion to make us hate, but not enough religion to make us love one another. You know, a lot of good things have been done in the name of religion. The work that we're a part of here at Netherland right now is great things that are being done in the name of Christianity, in the name of Christ. Powerful things. There have also been a lot of things that people who claim to have had good intentions with, but a lot of disastrous, a lot of hurtful things have been done in the name of Christ, in the name of Christianity. When 1 Corinthians 13 was given for me as the topic for this morning, it's a challenging text to preach on. And the reason why is you're jumping in the middle of one of Paul's thoughts here. 1 Corinthians 13 is often used as a passage that you hear at weddings. It's this great text on love, and that is, in essence, what it is. But we oftentimes miss why it was written, when it was written, the purpose of this text. So to do this text even the remote amount of justice, I want you to back up with me for a second. I want you to think with me about the spiritual state of the church at Corinth. This was a church that was in spiritual turmoil. You talk about the backbiting that was going on in this church. You talk about the hurt that was going on in the church. The church was in crisis. People were being swept away by elegant speakers, and that's why Paul comes to them and he says, "Look, God chose the foolish of the world to trump the things that the world looks at as wise. God's wisdom is so above the world's wisdom that the world looks at His wisdom oftentimes as foolishness." These people jumped on these bandwagons of, "I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Peter." And Paul shuts that down. He says, "Hey, look, if you're following a preacher, you're following the wrong person." See, I used to, going to preaching school, there was a lot of things that they used to tell us to keep records of. And I started in that bandwagon because, hey, I'm paying you a lot of money to teach me how to do this thing, so I'm going to do it. But I remember there was a preacher that would, you know, he kept track of every gospel meeting he'd ever done. He knew the date, the time, all of it. Now, there was some wisdom there. I did start keeping track of those things so that you don't go back and preach the same lessons at the same place, because after a while they remember those things. It might not be the first time you go back, but the second or third time of the same sermon, they'll catch on to those things. But they used to keep track of how many people they baptized. They could tell you every name, every number of the people that they baptized. And boy, they held that in great pride. And oftentimes you may even see it in a preacher's obituary. He baptized over however many hundreds, thousands of souls. You know, I find that interesting to me because I don't think that would have ever been written in Paul's obituary.
In fact, Paul says, I'm glad I didn't baptize any of you. And then he goes back and he says, you know, there's a couple of y'all that I did baptize, but I'm really glad I didn't baptize you because I'm so thankful that you people don't look at me and say, I'm following Paul. No, he says, I want you to follow Jesus. That's who you're supposed to be following after, not some man. You say, Eric, we still have these same problems in the church today. And yeah, we do. Churches get so caught up over who their preacher is, who this person is. Well, I like the youth minister, or I like the preacher, or I like the associate minister a little better, and I kind of cling to that person, and I cling to that person. And Paul would look at you and say, that's foolishness. They're just men. They're just men. This church, they didn't know their identity. They didn't know who they were to be founded on. And what happens when Paul leaves? Guess what? If we follow Paul, Paul's gone. Who are we going to follow now? What happens when Apollos packs up and leaves town? Or Apollos passes on? Who are we going to follow? He says, guess what? You need to get back to the basics. You need to get back to your foundation being Jesus. The church was in such a spiritual crisis they had taken, and they had overlooked certain sins. Some sins were okay, but they had allowed sin to come into the church. And I don't know if it was a status thing or if it was they were just embarrassed of the sin thing that just kind of sweep it under the rug. Don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. You had a church that was in such spiritual crisis, they could not even center around the Lord's table in its purest form and partake of that together. You had bickering and fighting over tradition, over things that didn't matter in the grand scheme of things, because ultimately you had cultures from different backgrounds coming together under one roof, trying to be one body. And Paul says, you're going to have to be mindful of these things when you're together. Because not everybody was raised just like you. Not everybody comes from the same background just like you. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you had these Christians that came up and said, you know what, I'm a little better than you because I've got a certain spiritual gift. I've got the ability to prophesy, or I've got the ability to speak in tongues, and that makes me more value to the church. I said this on a few Wednesday nights ago. There's two things I'm going to repeat from that Wednesday night class, and I'm doing that on purpose. First thing is this, is we've kind of done that with men in worship. We've kind of even done that in Christianity with men in the church, that men are a little better, we're a little above, because different roles, and I'll stand on that because the book stands on that. There's different roles that we have in the church based upon that God has given us as men and women, but that does not make one role of more value or of more essentiality to the health of the church than any other. And oftentimes with men, we take this role of standing up in front of the church. Well, that young man could lead a prayer. Why doesn't he get up and lead a prayer? How about instead of trying to push him to get up and lead a prayer, help him find what his ability in the body is? Because I'm going to tell you, it doesn't make him any less of a man or any more of a man if he gets up and leads a public prayer, or if he's the one working in the back of the church that you never hear from. That role is of no more value than the other. And that's what Paul's getting at in 1 Corinthians 12. He says, look, you've got all these spiritual gifts, and you guys don't understand that the way the body functions is that every part of the body doesn't need to be a hand. Every part doesn't need to be a feet. It doesn't need to be an ear. And if I'm getting a little fired up this morning, I'm sorry, but this is just one of those topics that I guess it just hits me, hits home with me. Paul says every part of the body has its own purpose. And every purpose is essential into the body being healthy and functioning the way that it should function. And then as Paul closes or begins this thought, as we would say chapter 13, really he's just continuing his thought here. At the end of chapter 12, he says, but earnestly desire the higher gifts. And he says, and I'll show you still a more excellent way. Now Paul gets into the solution for every problem the church is experiencing in Corinth. Every issue, every struggle that they are having, the answer is found in chapter 13. And sometimes when I look at the church today, I don't know why we've missed that. When I look at the areas we struggle in the church, why we haven't gone back to chapter 13 and say, maybe we need to start here in finding the solution. Because that's the exact place that Paul began with the solution. In chapter 13, Paul writes, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all the knowledge and have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I have not love, I'm nothing.
If I give away all I have, if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. I gain nothing. Paul lists five spiritual gifts here. But he shows us here in the first three verses that it's love that enriches them. It's love that gives them substance. It's love that gives them any value whatsoever. You can be the greatest at something, he says, but if you do not have love, it's nothing. It's nothing. You could give your body up, he says, as an offering to be burned, but if it wasn't done out of love, he says, it was useless. It was pointless. What was the point of it? I was thinking about this as I was studying through this from the eyes of a minister. Ministry without love cheapens both the minister and those who are touched by it. But ministry with love enriches the whole church. Ministry without love cheapens both the minister and those who are touched by it. But ministry with love enriches the whole church. That is one of the reasons why I believe the church in its purest form was designed that we were all to be in one way, shape, or form ministers to one another. Because we keep the personalization of it. You don't take the personal faith away from an individual at that moment. I've often wondered, and I've asked the question in Bible classes before, when did the work of the church as a whole fall on a preacher? When did that start? When was it all of a sudden the preacher's job to visit the sick, everyone that's sick? And people say, oh, there's just something special about when the preacher visits you. Why? Could it be that we're a follower of that person and not a follower of Jesus? Could it be that that person is of more value to us than even Jesus himself? I've had people that are consumed with people visiting them in and out, and they'll remember that one person that didn't come and visit them. And that always amazed me. You've had so many people come that you can't remember everyone who's come, but you can remember that one that didn't, can't you? And sometimes I don't think we understand how this thing works and how ministry works. And I think we've cheapened it because we've removed love from it and we put titles to it. And we've given these responsibilities to certain titles that God didn't even give the responsibilities to. And it cheapens ministry is what it does. But a ministry that is motivated and moved out of love, that is enriched. And not only does one person get enriched by it, the whole church gets enriched by it. Paul says everything that we do, our function in the church, everything we do, the motivating factor behind it has to be love. And if the motivating factor is not love, you are wasting your time doing it. It's a waste. So when we look at the church and we look at our families and we look at our priorities as families, and we say, well, why do we do these things? Well, we do them because we do them. Not a good enough answer. Or we look at the church and we look at what we're doing in the church as a whole, as a body, and we say, why do we do these things? Well, we just do them because we've always done them. Not the right answer. What's the motivating factor for why we're doing what we're doing? Love. The motivating factor for why you're here this morning should be love. It shouldn't be just because I'm supposed to be here. It should be because I love to be here. I love it. I feel empty when I don't have it. I miss it. Love is what enriches everything we do. It's the motivating factor behind everything we do. Love is at the very core of our beliefs. In 1 John chapter 4, John writes these words. He says, beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God. Whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent His only Son into the world so that we might live through Him. And this is love. Not that we have loved God, but He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us and His love is perfected in us. People say, well, Eric, you're talking a little too much about love. I don't like it when preachers talk about love. Love is the very core of who we are. It's the very core of our belief system. In fact, Christianity can be summed up in the word love. Jesus himself summed it up and said, the greatest command is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. That is the core of Christianity in a nutshell, love. It is the core of our belief. It's the core of who we are. It should be a defining symbol of who we are in our everyday lives, whether it be together as the body, whether it be in our homes as a family, whether it be in the community as neighbors. Love has to be the defining marker of who we are. Paul goes on to say, beginning in verse 4, he says, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but it rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. You see, love is edifying. Love is not only enriching, but love is edifying. Love builds up. In fact, he says earlier in chapter 8 and verse 1, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Love is encouraging. Love strengthens us. It builds us up. It draws us not only closer together, but it draws us closer to our God. Paul is ultimately looking at them and saying, church, I hope you realize what I'm saying to you here. That love would remove so many of your faults and so many of your stains. You look back at all of the struggles that Corinth was dealing with up to this point. Love, as I said, is the solution. Love is patient. Well, guess what? When you bring a bunch of Christians together from different backgrounds, different ways of thinking, different heritages, you name it, different, and you bring them together under one roof, guess what you're going to have a lot of? Patience. I didn't realize this until, you know, my aunt, I told the college age class this morning, I took it kind of to heart in a negative way, and then I moved away for a while and realized what she was trying to get at. I was raised in a church bubble, is what I call it, the church bubble. And in a lot of ways, if you were raised in the Bible Belt, you were raised in the church bubble, because we have churches on every street corner. We don't know what it's like, for the most part, to have to go. You know, but then my wife was raised just outside of the church bubble in Illinois, where you're going to have to drive 60 to 70 miles to get to another Church of Christ. Every town didn't have one in town. They all kind of found one that was like centralized on the interstate to where they could all have easier access to. You didn't have that access. And my aunt then went at one time, when my aunt is married to a retired Air Force veteran, and at the time they were stationed in Las Vegas, Nevada. Can you imagine trying to find a church there? Woo! She called me one time and she said, you know, we found a church here. She said, but there's a lot of differences. She said, the core stuff, the salvation stuff, that's the same. She says, there's still a lot of things that are different though. And we talked about it, and she said, you know, you think you only know the answers because you're in your little bubble. But she says, once you get out of that bubble and you start realizing there's not a church for over 100 miles, and you've got people from all different backgrounds that are trying to follow the truth and trying to do the right thing, and different cultures coming together, there's a lot of compromise and patience that has to come into play. And then I moved away and I met people from all over the world, and I listened to them, and they would tell me things like one of my friends, Simba, from Zimbabwe. Simba said, you know, I can't believe some of the stuff y'all argue about. And I was, then we were talking about it, and I was like, you know, you're right. Some of the stuff we argue about, when the solution is found here, love is patient. Love is kind. Love doesn't keep this record of faults. Love doesn't go and keep an ammunition box. I joke with Brittany. Don't ever joke with counselors. They don't have a good sense of humor. they'll always try to analyze your jokes too much. But I joke with her and I say, you know, I'll ask her, I say, am I talking to Brittany, my wife, or Brittany, my therapist? Because my therapist takes notes. My wife, a lot of times, doesn't. And I jokingly say, you know, that notepad you're taking down there, figuratively, she doesn't really have one. But I'm like, that's your ammunition box for later, isn't it? Do you remember on February the 1st, 2022, when you said this, you know, jokingly, of course. But I refer to it as the ammunition box.
keeps no record of wrong. It doesn't store things up in my ammunition box to use against you later in the future. So many of these things that we struggle with in our culture, in the church today, Paul gives us so clearly the resolution right here. Love. It's patient with one another. It's kind. It's not rude. It doesn't boast. It's not about trying to build itself up. It's about building others up. It's not about building a certain status. And I look at Christianity, and for all its good and all the things that I love about it, there are times I want to just shout these words from Paul. And I want to shout it because I want the church to hear it, and I want the church to take it to heart. You know, I had an elder tell me one time at a church, he said, you know, our eldership, we were the status quo of elderships. I thought, is that really what you're aspiring to be, the status quo? All the churches in the areas would call us for advice on the spiritual matters, and we would tell them how it was supposed to be done. And I just stop and I'm like, so who's this about boasting? What's this about boasting, building up? Who's being built up here? It sounds like y'all's egos are being built up. Not the church. Not the church. You see, we get into these status games where we're in competitions with one another all of a sudden. Where that came into be, I don't know. And Paul says the solution to this is love. Everything that Corinth was dealing with, if you look at all of these characteristics of what love is, it points back to a specific part that they were dealing with. And he says, there's your solution. And it's all wrapped up. Nicely packaged in a nice little, with a bow on it for you. It's called love. And it resolves it. If you get back to this. But see, Eric, we don't want to hear that today. That's watered down preaching. Talking about love. That's watered down preaching. No, I'll tell you, that's gospel preaching. That's gospel preaching. Because that's the solution that an inspired writer of God gave to the church that was going through spiritual turmoil. And I believe it's the solution that applies still some 2,000 years later today. The reason why I believe it still applies is not only is love edifying and building us up, but love is enduring. If you look at verses 8 through the end of the chapter, he says, love never ends. As for prophecies, they'll pass away. As for tongues, they'll cease. As for knowledge, it'll pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully. Even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide. These three. But the greatest of these is love. Although these gifts that the Corinthians thought so highly of would cease, Paul informs them that love will endure forever. Because God is ultimately love. As we looked in 1 John chapter 4, verses 8 and 16. Without God, there is no definition of love. The fact that we can even know what love is proof that there is a God. Because without Him, there is no definition of such thing. And Paul says, these things that you guys want so badly, that you put people up on pedestals for, that you put yourself up on pedestals for, they're gone. They're not eternal. They're temporary. You need to be searching after the thing that's eternal. See, the Corinthians were like young children playing with toys that would one day wear out, that would one day break, that would one day just be thrown away in the toy box, never to be played with again. And the thing is, we expect children to play with toys. We expect children to be fascinated by them. But we expect children to eventually mature as they grow and to start speaking and thinking like an adult. Mark has talked a lot in depth about spiritual maturity, and he's looked at it in ways that I've never even thought of from his background in counseling and dealing with people from different ages and how they develop in their maturity levels. And it's really challenged me, and I feel like it's helped me in my thinking a lot. But the one common thing that I get from that view and my understanding of it before is everyone's still expected to mature. Although we may mature at different rates, we're all still expected to show some sense of maturity. There has to be some level of growth that is taking place. Paul is making sure that these Christians, that they're not thinking so narrow-sighted. It's kind of the thing, you know, kids, you don't always understand the big picture of things. I remember one time with Kinley, and I knew I'd get away with this. She said, Dad, she said, I know what I want. I can't remember what she did, but she did something. I don't even think I promised her a reward for it, but she's a kid. She thinks she's got to be, you know, they don't understand your allowance. What allowance? You live under this house rent free. That's your allowance. That's what I always got told as a kid. I didn't get an allowance for cleaning my room. You live in this house rent free. That's, you know, your allowance. But she did something good. And she said, Daddy, I know what I want for my reward. And I said, what's that? And she said, I want $20. I looked at her. I said, how about an ice cream cone? She said, deal. I thought you don't realize what you just gave up. I'll gladly get you that ice cream. That's a lot cheaper than $20. See, a lot of times, Paul wanted to make sure the Corinthians weren't like little children. That they got so focused on the things that really didn't matter in the grand scheme that they forgot the big picture. That they forgot what was most important. That they didn't miss the forest for the trees. And he says, you know, at a time you thought like a child, but it's the time to start growing. As the Hebrew writer would say, look, some of you people by now ought to be mature adults desiring the meat of the word. In fact, I wonder what the Hebrew letter would have looked like if he didn't have to spend the first four chapters going over the basics of why they're Christians, not Jews. Because he says, I shouldn't have even had to go over this stuff with you. This is stuff you should have already known. I've often said maturity in Christians is not based upon a number. It's not based upon a number. It's not based upon how many years you've attended a congregation. It's not based upon how many years necessarily you've been a Christian. Because there are some Christians that have been Christians very few years that are far more out, that are far more mature than I'll probably ever be. And if we're going to play numbers, I mean, I became a Christian. I'll be a Christian 22 years in October. And I still believe I got a whole lot of maturing to do. And there are some people that have been Christians longer than I've been alive that still can't get over the milk of the Word. That want to have everything just bottle fed to them. Sadly. Paul says, I don't want you to get so caught up in these minute things. In these things that are temporary. These things that in the grand scheme that aren't going to matter. That you forget what's eternal. That you forget what's most important in these things. It's time for you to start thinking like an adult. It's time for you to put away childish things and live for what's permanent. Live for what is enduring. And what love produces will endure as well. Warren Wiersbe had this to say about here when he says faith, hope, and love. He says love is what energizes our faith and our hope. And I thought there was a lot of truth to that. Love is what energizes our faith and our hope. Love is the only three of those things that will be eternal with God. When Jesus comes back, our faith becomes sight. Our hope is made known, is given to us, is achieved. But our love endures forever because God is love. When I want you to think about what you are pursuing, not only in the church, but in the well-being for your family. I know that these lessons this year are geared towards our families, but Paul uses the home as the perfect illustration for the church. So I don't see how you can preach on the family without preaching on the church, because they're hand in hand. Because while you'll go home into your little subculture of your family today, right now as we are together, we're a family. So they're one and the same as far as I'm concerned. But I want to do a drill, a little test with you. If you've got a pen and paper, take it out. Please just take a few seconds. You know, this is the last thing we're going to do. Just humor me for a second with this. We did this on a Wednesday night. I didn't ask you to actually write it down. But I want to do this again for those that maybe weren't in attendance a few weeks ago for that class. This is where the rubber meets the road part. And this is where it gets challenging for me.
You can use, if you don't have a pen and paper, you can use your notepad in your phone. It's okay, I promise. You know, the Lord knows if you're texting or on Facebook, you'll take it up with Him. we're going to backtrack to something we've already read. 1 Corinthians 13, beginning of verse 4. This is something that I like to do personally in my life for self-reflection. I'm going to read through that passage again. And we're going to remove the word love. And in replace of the word love, I want you to put your name. And I'm going to put my name as I read through this. Just because I want you to know that anytime, I always tell people this, anytime there's one finger pointing at you, there's three fingers pointing back at me. So just because at times when the preacher seems like he's pointing fingers, I want you to know something, this preacher at least, I can only speak for me, that when there's one pointing outwards, I've always got three more pointing inwards. So I'm going to read this slowly. And every time the word love should be there, you're going to put your name down. And I want you to put, for example, is Eric patient? Let's read through this together slowly. Eric is patient and kind. Eric does not envy or boast. Eric is not arrogant or rude. Eric does not insist on his own way. Eric is not irritable or resentful. Eric does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. You know, the thing is, when I read that passage, far too often by the end, I feel like such a liar. I feel like such a liar. That if I'm meant to represent what love is, then I often fail to love people well. And while it gives me a challenge to work towards, I want to give you the light at the end of the tunnel now. I'm going to ask you to replace your name. Take your name out of the equation where love should be. And I'm going to take mine out. And here's the name we're going to replace it with. Jesus is patient and kind. Jesus does not envy or boast. Jesus is not arrogant. He is not rude. Jesus does not insist on his own way. He is not irritable or resentful. Jesus does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. When I think about it and I put my name there, I see how I can never fully live up to that perfect expectation, but I'm grateful that I wasn't expected to. That it was Christ that fully lives up to that expectation. And that by showing others that love that was shown for me through Him, people can see the perfection that is Jesus, and people can see the goodness that is Jesus, not because I'm perfect, but because He is. This morning, I want to challenge us in our homes. I want to challenge us in the church here at Netherland. At the end of the day, seek what is best for the church. Seek what is best for our families, not seeking what is best for our own personal selfishness. There's a fine line between the two. This morning, if you're not a Christian, we want to extend a time of invitation for you to make that need known. If you need to become a Christian, to respond out of love for Jesus and what He did for you, wanting to live your life for Him, we want to shower you with love at this time and support. If you're a Christian and you're struggling, we want to be patient and kind with you. We want to lift you up. We want to bear your burden and show you the love that we should be continually showing you. It's my prayer, though, as we leave here today, that of all the things that may be said in our communities in the days and years to come about Netherland, that there's one thing that'll never change, is that when people hear Netherland Church of Christ, they think of the word love. If you have a need, please come while we stand and while we sing.